Wired Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you feel like you've fallen into a boring routine in the last few months, maybe you need some novelty. Something, anything new, could boost your mood. Our guest makes the case for novelty and tells us why a change of seasons offers us some good opportunities. First, the Senate Judiciary Committee started its confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett today. Democrats on the committee used their opening statements to talk about what a larger conservative majority on the court could mean for a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, scheduled to be heard on November 10th. Some Republican senators tried to head off criticism that the process is hypocritical after they had refused to consider a nominee in 2016, citing the need to wait until after the presidential election. Here's Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham.
This is a vacancy that's occurred through a tragic loss of a great woman, and we're going to fill that vacancy with another great woman. The bottom line here is that the Senate is doing its duty constitutionally.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the prospect of Judge Amy Coney Barrett being confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court? Are you worried or hopeful about what that would mean for issues like health care and abortion rights? If you want to see a larger conservative majority on the court, do you think this confirmation should happen before the election? Is the Supreme Court a voting issue for you, wherever you are on the political spectrum? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ali Massoud is an assistant professor of political science at Rhodes College in Memphis. His research focuses on the courts and judicial politics. Ali, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, when one is choosing a Supreme Court nominee, you've got, at least a handful of people to choose from. From the perspective of the Trump administration, why Amy Coney Barrett as the selection now?
Well, for President Trump, she's a very safe choice. She's reliably conservative. President Trump earlier nominated her to be on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, so she has some experience there. Her decisions have been conservative, although not entirely. And she's been vetted very recently. So this would mean that she would go through what many would expect as a very smooth nomination process.
Now, you sent us some charts trying to give a sense of where she fit in on the ideological spectrum compared to some other potential nominees, compared to current Supreme Court justices. Where do you see Judge Barrett, again, based on the record we have of her?
Sure. So political scientists have developed measures to capture an individual's ideology. So one of the ones a lot of judicial scholars use are known as Martin Quinn scores, which place judges and judicial nominees on an ideological spectrum. So looking at her, and these are based on the judges' prior votes, right? So they're dynamic, they change as they cast each new vote. So looking at that, Judge Barrett, who would, if confirmed, would become Justice Barrett, falls somewhere in the middle between Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito on one side, on further to the right, and falls in between them and Chief Justice Roberts and President Trump's more recent nominees, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh. So what this suggests, what these ideology scores suggest, that should Judge Barrett be confirmed, that she would be closer to Justices Thomas and Alito, but a little bit to the left of them. And then there would be another coalition of conservative justices, which would be to the center right, which would be Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Kavanaugh.
And then the move from Justice Ginsburg to a potential Justice Barrett would be a pretty big shift on the court, right?
Yeah, it's a very significant shift, because Justice Ginsburg was on this ideological spectrum, was furthest to the left. So any move away from that, even if there was another liberal justice, would be a move away from where she was on that scale. But a justice to the right would certainly move the median in a strong way. And it appears that Judge Barrett, compared to President Trump's prior nominees, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, would move the pendulum a little bit further to the right. So it would give the court a solid 6-3 majority in favor of conservatives.
Now, a weird thing about our judge process in the United States, whether it's a confirmation process like for a U.S. Supreme Court judge or a statewide election like we have here in Wisconsin for our Supreme Court, everybody wants to know how they're going to vote on different issues, I think, as far as members of the public who are paying attention. And the one kind of question that these judges will not answer is how they would vote on particular issues. So, I don't know, is there a disconnect between what we want to know and what we find out?
Sure. So this goes back to the unsuccessful confirmation process of Robert Bork. And what we've learned from that and what judicial nominees have learned from that, both at the lower court levels and at the Supreme Court level, is that you're best served, you increase your chances of successful confirmation by not answering specific questions. This is a precedent that's been followed by judicial nominees since, right? So what they do is they talk in general terms about their philosophy, how they would potentially rule, how they view precedent, how they view law, existing Supreme Court doctrine, but they refuse to answer questions about individual issues. And usually the reasoning they provide is it's something that's very intuitive and we can buy, which is that some of these matters are likely to come before the court. So they would not want to bias their judgment by disclosing and prejudging the issue prior to them adjudicating that when it formally arrives to the court.
We are talking about the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. A committee hearing kicked off today. Ali Massoud is with us from Rhodes College. You could join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, I'm so excited for Notre Dame. I am a graduate from Notre Dame myself, and I was surprised to learn that she'll be the first appointee or nominee not having graduated from Yale or Harvard, and I think Notre Dame is an excellent choice because when you're a student at Notre Dame, you're taught about the God, country, Notre Dame. You're taught about Notre Dame values. And one of those values is the sanctity of human life. And what that means in our Constitution, for example, is that the right to life comes from our Creator, not from the government. The government doesn't give us rights. Our inalienable rights come from our Creator, and that's in the Constitution. So for all those Catholics who've prayed for an end to abortion, I mean, she's an excellent choice. Our nation will be blessed tremendously when we finally stop killing babies.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I think he's referring to the Declaration of Independence there with the rights coming from the Creator. But that aside, Ali, your thoughts on her educational background and her connection of faith to the law, as Jeff was bringing up there.
Yeah, so one minor correction I would make is that to what Jeff said is that, yes, she would be, if confirmed, the only justice that's active, that has not graduated from Harvard or Yale Law School. But there have been justices in the past, but she would be the only one on the current court. In terms of, there's a lot of discussion, especially on Roe v. Wade and the issue of abortion. I think one of the things that's important to understand is that a single justice, while they can sway the vote, the majority usually has a more muted impact, right? The justices are a group of nine, and even if there's a split ideological coalition of conservatives versus liberals, you still have to craft an opinion in a matter that holds on to that majority, right? One of the things that does, especially with Chief Justice Roberts wanting to preserve the legitimacy of the court, is to make sure that the court doesn't veer too far off to the right or to the left. So it's possible the Supreme Court takes a different position based on changes in the membership of the court, but you do have to maintain that and preserve that majority without alienating other votes.
Jeff, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Ali Massoud, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rhodes College, looking at Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett and the confirmation process getting started today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the prospect of Judge Barrett being confirmed and giving the court a bigger conservative majority? Should this confirmation process be happening now at all, do you think, based on the Merrick Garland nomination being put off till after the election? What issues are you worried about, hopeful about, with a possible change on the court? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ali Massoud, assistant professor of political science at Rhodes College, looking at the confirmation hearings this week for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the nomination. What do you want to hear from and about the nominee in these hearings? Whether you think the process should be going on now at all, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. There's been some talk, Ali, about will Democrats want to add justices to the court if this nomination goes through and if they won, obviously, the presidential election. What are your thoughts on this idea of so-called court packing?
Yeah, so court packing is getting a lot of attention. We first became familiar with this phrase during President FDR's presidency, where he threatened to pack the court because the Supreme Court was consistently ruling against his policies. In contemporary times, while this is an idea that's been floated around, it's very unlikely. We're making lots of assumptions. The first assumption is that the Democrats would win the presidency. In addition to that, the Democrats would need to win a majority in the Senate. And if that were to happen, the United States Senate would have to change its rules. In 2017, the U.S. Senate changed its rules to go to a simple majority when it came to confirming Supreme Court justices. Now, in order to add additional justices to the court, you would have to change Senate rules that would go beyond just judicial nominees. So you'd have to pass legislation to add additional seats to the court, whether it's one seat or multiple seats. And in order to do that, that would be subject to the senatorial filibuster. So the only way to really practically pack the court would be to eliminate completely the senatorial filibuster from all legislation, for the Democrats to have a majority in the Senate to win the presidency, and then wanting to add additional justices. If that were to happen, yes, in theory, the Democrats could pack the court. They could add one or multiple members to the court. But you know, the political pendulum swings both ways. That once you set this precedent when it comes to senatorial policy, the next time another party is in office and control both the presidency and the Senate, there would be nothing to stop that party to add additional seats, right? And so we can, in theory, keep adding seats, and that would, in the long run, impact the legitimacy of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I would say with the sympathy to the idea of fighting abortion as a way of preserving human life, I am very concerned that Republicans are pushing this a candidate for the Supreme Court with the hopes that she will be a conservative activist judge that will get rid of Obamacare and in that way contribute to the ruining or loss of human life, because Obamacare has been extremely helpful to many people in the U.S. And if I can sneak in a remark about the last thing you talked about, I would say instead of court packing, considering what happened to Merrick Garland, would this be trying to counterbalance arguably ill-gotten gains, or even just having a neutral system where regardless of the number of judges, every president gets to appoint one at the beginning of a term?
Nate, thanks for the call. A couple big points there, Ali. Let's start with that second point first. Democrats say, well, Republicans did their own version of, I've seen some people call it court stacking, by holding up not just Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland, but a bunch of appeals court justices, too. What do you think about that argument, first of all?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. So just to add a little bit of context, there's been a lot of discussion about President Trump's judicial nominees throughout the federal judiciary in the trial courts and the Court of Appeals and now the U.S. Supreme Court. So I looked up some recent nominations from recent presidents, President Obama, President George W. Bush, President Bill Clinton. The numbers are pretty much in line. Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton nominated a total of somewhat over 300 judicial nominees across the judicial hierarchy. President Trump is at 218. Judge Barrett would make 219. So it's a little bit ahead of schedule. It's a little bit faster paced, but it's not out of the norm or in a different dimension. It is important to note that those other presidents were elected to two terms. So President Trump has made a lot of headway in just one term, but it's not something that it's extraordinary in terms of packing the lower courts. Now, in terms of the process, I think it's very interesting going back to the nomination of Judge Garland, who at that time was the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is important because it's considered the minor leagues for the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot of judicial nominees, a lot of justices emerge from the D.C. Circuit. So to be the chief judge, you're considered highly qualified. But what we've learned from this process is the Constitution is silent on how what the political process is. So the only thing the Constitution talks about is the president gets to nominate and the Senate gets to advise and consent, which is the confirmation process. So what we're likely to see moving forward is instead of a president getting a single nomination, what that would require is for there to be a vacancy on the court when a president is selected. What we're likely to see is that Supreme Court confirmations and perhaps confirmations for judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals only move forward when we have some uniformity in government, which is when one party controls both the presidency and the Senate. And if we have divided government where we might have one party controlling the presidency, but a different party controlling the Senate, we're unlikely to see these judicial, following this, the Garland precedent, we're likely to see, unlikely to see these nominations move forward.
And Nate also mentioned the Affordable Care Act. Supreme Court will start a hearing about a week after Election Day. Can you talk about Judge Barrett and how she fits into that?
Yeah, there's been some discussion that one of the impetus to move forward with Judge Barrett's nomination prior to the election is for her to have an opportunity to be on the court by the time the Supreme Court hears this case. This is likely to be the first case Judge Barrett hears as a potential new justice if she were to be confirmed immediately before or immediately after the November election. So she's been on the record criticizing Chief Justice Roberts on how much leeway he had in terms of upholding the healthcare mandate. She's not ruled on an improminent healthcare decisions. But what this suggests, what her word suggests, is that she disagrees with the outcome and would be a vote to overturn that process. So if we were to replace Justice Ginsburg's vote with a hypothetical vote by Judge Barrett, that would suggest that 5-4 majority would flip the other way. Now, one of the things that the justices as a coalition, not just Justice Barrett, but the additional conservatives on the court have to grapple with is what do we do with recent precedents that we've announced, and if we were to come back a few years later and overturn them, what does that mean for stare decisis, and what does that mean for upholding precedent and adhering to law? So these are things that they'll discuss and contend with, and will issue some kind of ruling once they take all of this into account.
Talking to Ali Massoud from Rhodes College, looking at the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, the confirmation hearing starting today. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Eau Claire. Mike, hello.
Hi, this is Mike. I am extremely disappointed, bitterly disappointed in what's going on. I think it's so disingenuous of the Republicans to do what they're doing and with regard to what they did to Merrick Garland. I think they are packing the court to have a 6-3 majority with judges appointed for life. It's going to be a very long time till it can be changed. I'm actually angry about the whole process. And I think, I truly think that the Republicans really don't care if it's Democratic or if there's any kind of consensus. I'm really not happy what's happening in the country now. They do nothing but contribute to more divisiveness.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ali. The idea that Mike is worried that this is divisive, and he says a power grab in effect by conservatives.
Yeah. Just following the political process, there's nothing to stop the Republicans in the Senate from moving the confirmation forward. There have been two Republican senators, Senators Susan Collins and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who've gone on the record saying that they oppose any nominee this in such close proximity to the presidential election. But I think the other side of this is that, well, the nomination is bearing some unforeseen event or some news that comes out. If it is successful, there might be some kind of political cost to pay. We're seeing these races for senator, including the senatorial race for the Senate Judiciary Committee chairperson, Lindsey Graham, that they've tightened up significantly. So it's possible that one of the repercussions of pushing through a nomination in such close proximity to an election is that some senators might lose their seats.
And let's ask that in our last minute. How important do you think voters see these U.S. Supreme Court seats when they're voting for a senator or a president?
Yeah, so when it comes to the Supreme Court, there's been a lot of academic research that suggests that the U.S. Supreme Court enjoys what's known as a reservoir of goodwill. Among the three branches of government, between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, the judiciary consistently has the highest approval ratings, the most support, the highest levels of legitimacy when it comes to the broader public. But an important way to preserve that is for the Supreme Court to issue decisions that are not considered overly partisan or ideological. While they might issue some ideological decisions along 5-4 or potentially 6-3 lines, if they were to issue every decision like that, they would lose broader legitimacy, right? In the last term, only a small percentage of decisions were 5-4 along ideological lines. The vast majority, over 50% Supreme Court decisions, are unanimous. So it's important for the court to maintain that. And when it comes to the public, the public cannot hold justices or really any Article III judge, any federal judge, accountable, because these are lifetime appointments. So what the public, the only recourse that's available to the public is to vote for a president that would nominate candidates that are like-minded to them and that would be agreeable to them, and to vote for senators who would have some kind of majority that would only confirm federal judges or Supreme Court justices that are in line with their own thinking. So the only accountability really is to the elected branches, but not the court.
Ali, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
Ali Massoud is an assistant professor of political science at Rhodes College in Memphis. He talked to us about this week's confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. For many parts of the U.S., this month marks the 7th month of living during a pandemic. We've delayed things, canceled trips, and tried to make do with what we have. And we've settled in many cases into routines that include a lot of sameness. The neighborhood walk, watching Netflix, going grocery shopping, and for some people, working from home. There's not a lot of change happening, but our next guest says a little novelty is exactly what we all need right now. And the fall season offers some good ways to do that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself being particularly appreciative of fall this year? Have you taken a drive to look at fall colors? Are you happy to wear some other clothing and embrace layering now that the weather has changed? Are you welcoming some of those cozy things, the candles, the tea, the cider, whatever? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nisha Chital is a journalist who works at Vox.com and writes their weekly newspaper, Nisha's Internet Tote Bag. She recently wrote a newsletter about novelty. Nisha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What got you, Nisha, thinking about novelty in this time of these weird routines we've developed into?
Well, as you said, we're now in month 7, I think, of spending more of our time at home than we ever have before, and I realized that just some of the natural changes that come with fall, such as bringing your fall clothes out of the back of the closet or out of storage. Some of those things that you sort of in a normal year would take for granted as something you always do felt really, really refreshing this year. I was reading some studies, which eventually read to me writing this newsletter. There are studies that show that the human brain is really stimulated by novel things. And it really responds well to novelty, and the brain is sort of rewarded by that. So I realized that things like different clothes for fall or different decor at home or different foods, all of those things that sort of naturally come with fall felt very novel and very exciting this year, even though they're small things, they're small changes. It's nothing huge, but it's a year when we can't have a lot of big changes. So that just a little bit of novelty after doing, you know, kind of the same things for the past 6 months, the same routines, the same foods, the same clothes, just these small bits of novelty felt really refreshing and kind of rejuvenating.
And had you been feeling this kind of lack of novelty in your own daily life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, I realized kind of over the summer as we got to like month four and month five and month six, I just felt like, you know, and I, many of my friends and colleagues and family members felt the same. I started to feel like every day is just the same because we had sort of locked into these new pandemic life routines that we thought in the beginning in March, perhaps, it also felt novel in a different way, not necessarily in a good way because our lives were sort of being thrown into disarray, but it was very new and novel at the time. And then we sort of set into this new life of we're social distancing. We're not having big gatherings. Many of the things we like to do are closed. We're not traveling. If you know, many people are working from home. And so these routines kind of calcified and I did start to feel sort of stagnant, if you will.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page to weigh in on whether they're looking forward to or enjoying the changes of fall. Now, Marjorie writes, the beauty of the trees changing their coats from green is always awesome. Cooler days and wearing sweaters is a tradition I love. Long walks with crunching leaf debris and all the earthy smells are great. That let's talk about the middle part there, that change of wardrobe. Again, you mentioned that briefly. That's not something I usually think that much about, but I agree. It's been kind of fun to even just reach for the long sleeves instead of the short sleeves. Is that the kind of little change you're hoping we can appreciate more this year?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the funny part is that happens every year. This isn't, you know, it's not particularly new because it's 2020, but it's just something different than the past 6 months. Like I wore the same t-shirts for the past 6 months. And so to reach for a different, like a sweater that I haven't seen in 6 months, it feels, it just feels so refreshing to look at something new and different and to wear something new and different. And it's just like changing up your routine in really the smallest of ways. But that novelty really does, I think, make people feel better because our brains are sort of hardwired to seek out novelty.
We're talking about the routines of our lives, especially the ones we've settled into during the pandemic, and why we love novelty and how we seek it out and why fall might be a good time to find it. Nisha Chital is with us, a journalist. She wrote about this on her newsletter, Nisha's Internet Tote Bag. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you kind of tired of your pandemic era routine? Have you found ways to bust out of it? And are you finding comfort in the change of the seasons one way or another? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. We also asked some of our colleagues here at WPR if they had found ways to shake things up. Mark Riker is a digital producer with, to the best of our knowledge, says he rearranges his desk every 2 to 3 weeks, including the cabling behind and underneath it. Mark says he tells himself it's better use his mic or arrange the screens, but he admits it's getting a little ridiculous at this point. So just shaking up things in our workspace. I think that's a working at home space in this case. What do you think, Nisha, just redesigning the space around us from time to time?
I think that's a great idea. I actually really wish I had the space to do that since our new work from home reality. I now work at my my kitchen table, so there's not a lot of space for me to, you know, I don't have like a dedicated desk that I could rearrange and redesign my workspace. But if I did have one, I would absolutely, I think, be doing that right alongside your colleague. I think I would also be rearranging my things. I've definitely had, I think, a lot of people. There's actually a great article in The Atlantic last week about how Americans are turning to a lot more sort of like home improvement and DIY projects to reorganize or redecorate their space because we're spending so much time at home. So I think there's definitely, I definitely understand the urge to do that.
We also heard from health reporter Shemaine Mills, who says she's not a cook, but she's taken up fermentation. She experiments with all sorts of vegetables and loves and loathes the results. She examples she gives: purple cabbage, beautiful and tangy; cauliflower, bitter and smells of death; sweet peppers fermented with celery are amazing; best so far, pickled rhubarb. I've heard, and this is since the beginning, we've heard from a lot of people, Nisha, who have taken up maybe a new hobby or rekindled an old one. Do you see that as something that's still a good way to add some novelty to our lives?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've heard from a lot of people who have gotten more into cooking or baking, or people who learn to knit, or they're trying to learn a language or read a book that's been on their bucket list. I think that can be a great way to introduce some novelty and pass the time too. I also think there's like there's a balance to be struck. Some people feel like, you know, the pandemic is so exhausting that they're just trying to get through the days and they don't also have the time to learn a language or learn how to bake bread or, you know, read the classics. So I think everyone has to do, you know, sort of what works for them. But for those who are seeking a little bit of novelty, tackling some of those like sort of bucket list projects or learning a new skill or a language or taking up a hobby, I think can be a great solution to that.
We're talking to Nisha Chital, a journalist who works at Vox.com. She writes the weekly newsletter Nisha's Internet Tote Bag. She wrote a recent piece on novelty and why we could all use a little change right now and fall. The change of seasons can be a good way to find some. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself falling into, you know, kind of the same new routine in recent months? What do you do to find that novelty that our brains apparently crave? Have you found ways to shake things up? And is the change of seasons helping you do that? Appreciating maybe some of the fall standbys. Apple cider, that's one of mine, in new ways. Fall colors, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if there's a non-seasonal way you've found some novelty lately, 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Nisha Chital, journalist at Vox. Her weekly newsletter is Nisha's Internet Tote Bag. She recently wrote about novelty for her newsletter and why fall is maybe helping bring some small changes of pace that we really need right about now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you've been in a routine, maybe a boring routine? What do you do to shake it up to find that novelty that our brains want? And is the change of the seasons helping you do that? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls. Russ is with us in Pleasant Springs. Russ, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to say I'm 74 years old, and one of my fondest memories is that first day that you smell, and I don't know what it is, you smell the gas furnace kick on, and you're in the house, and you're wondering, what is that smell? And all of a sudden, it's the heat, and, you know, the sun is getting lower, coming through the windows. And I can remember that first realization as far back as I can remember. I grew up in Illinois, and it's that smell of the heat coming on.
Wow, Russ, thank you so much. Sounds like Russ has already been focused on that, Nisha. But finding those little details in our own homes find that sense of novelty sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And actually, I think my radiators at home kicked on this morning, and we noticed that smell too. So I can definitely relate. I know that you notice that every year around this time.
Yeah, mine is more that 75% of my household overrules me and decides it's time to turn on the heat before I'm quite ready. But that's definitely a sign of a changing season. Here's another one from one of our colleagues here, Alisa Nalbandian, our Southeastern Regional Manager, says her family biked the Elroy Sparta Trail this past weekend. They rode through tunnels and enjoyed a once-in-a-lifetime fall color. And that's a great way, getting out and enjoying nature as the colors change, Nisha, could be an easy way, or even just a local walk, a way to find that novelty in the changing of the season.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. What a great fall activity. I wish I had somewhere nearby to do that myself. But I think I'm going to be trying to take some fall hikes to see some fall foliage, hopefully soon too.
So how do we, if we feel like we're in a rut, you know, and we don't have that inspiration. Nisha, do you have thoughts on how we can look for, you know, either a big activity, a big long hike, or those little observations like Russ's about the heat? How can we, I guess, open our brains to be receptive to novelty?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, big changes are maybe harder. It's harder to make big changes happen right now in our lives, just because of the nature of the way the pandemic has sort of put restrictions on our lives. For me, I think it's all about sort of trying to notice and appreciate small things that we might have taken for granted before. I didn't even really think about the novelty thing until I pulled an old sweater from last fall out of the closet, and I realized how sort of exciting it felt to put on something, not new, but something I hadn't seen since before the pandemic. I think it's just trying to, I think a good place to start is just trying to be sort of like present in the moment and really noticing things around you. I think often we are, pulled into our phones, we're pulled into our screens, or we're either thinking about something that's in the future, or we're thinking about something that happened in the past, and we're not really thinking so much about the present moment and sort of noticing things around us. I think noticing things that are different or that have changed, or things you really appreciate, however small they may be, I think is a great way to start sort of noticing what feels novel and exciting to you.
Let's bring on another caller. Dwayne is with us in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. Just chilling out on our local lake a lot with the coronavirus, and, you know, you're not going to the shopping, you're not doing anything, and just the colors this year in this area anyway are just phenomenal. I mean, they've been, 2 weeks ago I said they were peaking, and it's just getting better every day yet, you know. I mean, it's just beautiful color, and when you're on the lake, you know, you see all the geese flying, and they're making their route south, and I just and when you called, I was making stuffed green peppers, so I'm doing more cooking. I'm trying to get new recipes, but I had a question. When you see the geese flying and they're in that V, you ever see that when they're in that V formation?
Sure.
You know, you ever notice how one side's always longer than the other? Can't you ever see that? Like,
sure.
You see more on one side. You know why that is?
I don't.
Do you know why?
No.
There's more geese on that side, apparently. Just a joke.
Okay. All right, Dwayne. Yeah, a little humor to give us some novelty there, Nisha. But one thing I like there is just, I guess, that sensitivity to the changing of the seasons, the colors, the migrating birds, things like that. Is that something you feel more mindful of, it sounds like, this year, Nisha?
Yeah, I'm really trying to be. I live really close to a very nice park. And to be honest, I think in past years, I did not take advantage of living so close to a great park, or I didn't take advantage of it as much as I should have. Now that, you know, there's not many places to go or things to do, and outdoor gatherings are generally, outdoors is better in the time of coronavirus. I've spent a lot more time in the park. Sometimes you have a book or something to read, but sometimes I just like to sit and sort of like notice and be aware of my surroundings. And I really appreciate that outdoor that outdoor space and change of scenery a lot more than maybe I did in previous years.
Nisha, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a fun topic.
Nisha Chital is a journalist who works at Vox.com and writes the weekly newsletter Nisha's Internet Tote Bag. She joined us to talk about novelty and why fall has brought some welcome change to our ongoing routines lately. We've got a link to her piece, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time if you'd like to take a look. As Wisconsin became one of the country's COVID hotspots, the debate over how much information the public should have about local outbreaks also heated up. For example, the state doesn't report K-12 schools with confirmed cases as some parents and teachers would like. Shemaine Mills reports that health officials across the state say they're walking a fine line between privacy and sharing critical information.
Back in March, when very little was known about coronavirus, UW-Madison student Amy Schursel announced on social media she had the illness. The 22-year-old wanted to warn other young people they too could be vulnerable to the virus. It kept her bedridden for 2 weeks with a fever, dehydration, and extreme fatigue.
So sick. I honestly never been that sick in my life, and I hope I'm never that sick again.
While most of the feedback she received was positive, some wasn't.
Other people who are like, she only got it because she's too fat. She's too lazy, and that's why she's sick. Just like really like mean stuff.
Schursel, who now lives and works in California, was also open about her name and her hometown. When health officials or school districts announce infections, they can't reveal information that could identify a person. But sometimes it happens inadvertently, especially in small communities. When Bayfield School District had its first known case of COVID-19, officials notified parents, students, and staff by text, telephone, and social media that a high schooler was infected. Word soon spread who it might be, even though gender, grade, or name were not shared, says an attorney who represents the school, Steve Weld.
You know, Bayfield, like most communities in northern Wisconsin, are small communities. Frankly, it didn't take Dick Tracy to figure out who was involved.
Bayfield Public Health Director Sarah Wartman later found out the infected teen and her family received unwanted attention on Facebook and at their home by people wanting to know if they were indeed quarantined.
Had I known that as it was happening and been made aware of it, I could have put some made some actions that could have been protective for that family, could have potentially offered to have the family or the person be put in a hotel room for their safety.
Or, she says, even posted guards outside the family's home to make sure, in Wartman's words, they weren't harassed. School districts and public health departments are both subject to laws that allow them to alert the community about infectious diseases, but they must try to maintain as much privacy for the individual as possible. Denise Chrysler is with the Network for Public Health Law.
With students, and especially students in elementary and high school, it's extremely sensitive whether COVID should have stigma or not have stigma. It does have stigma.
But Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council says how people perceive COVID changes as more people get the disease. He stresses that details about cases is vital information the public needs during a pandemic.
Parents have a right to know if there have been cases of COVID-19 that have been confirmed in the schools that their children attend.
The Bayfield County High School case occurred in March. Now there have been more than 130 known infections in the county. Like the rest of the state, the COVID-19 cases come from workplaces, family gatherings, and sporting events. Keeping track of those cases is the job of state and local health officials who try to balance public safety with protecting privacy. Those who voluntarily come forward with COVID information, like Amy Schursel, may get a reaction they didn't want or expect. But she says she wouldn't do anything different. She didn't want anyone else to suffer. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Trump administration is backing a lawsuit that would overturn the Affordable Care Act, making health care a big issue in the presidential race. We'll compare the candidates' plans and statements on the topic. Opioid addiction is still a problem in Wisconsin, and the pandemic is creating unique problems when it comes to treatment. A Wisconsin doctor joins us with the latest on the long-running problem. And we'll hear from congressional candidates in the November election with a race in South Central Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.